Please could you say your name?
It's Sarah Howard.
And when did you start working or volunteering at Bristol Crisis Service for Women?
In the spring of 1994.
And how old were you then?
Oh, that would have been 34, I think.
How did you find out about Bristol Crisis Service for Women?
I had seen adverts in Venue magazine. It was the local listings magazine. And I'd seen over a period of time a number of adverts for Womenkind and Bristol Crisis Service for Women asking if you wanted to join the helpline. I rang up once, and I don't know whether I rang Bristol Crisis Service for Women or Womenkind, but they put me off. And then a few years later, I thought, well, I'll give it another go. I think I could do this, because I hadn't ever really done any counselling or anything really. So I rang and spoke to somebody, and they said, yes, I should be, you know, I could come and join the training. I think I went in to see somebody, but I can't quite remember. It was a long time ago. So I joined the training.
What were your motivations for joining the training?
I think I just wanted to do something, to give something back, something I possibly could do. And I think I just wanted to do something different.
Were you looking to get involved with a women-only organisation?
I think that was attractive because I always have had a feminist outlook, and it seemed... And I also worked in a very male-dominated workplace, so it seemed like the opposite would be good.
What was your role when you joined Bristol Crisis Service for Women?
When I joined, it was still a collective. So we were told that we would get involved in everything. But obviously the training was directed at working on the helpline. So it was initially to do the helpline, but to get involved in everything. I do know that a lot of people didn't get very much involved apart from the helpline. That was later on. But at the time it was... Yeah, you would be joining the helpline and doing other things as well.
Can you tell me a bit more about what was involved in the training?
Once again, it was rather a long time ago. I knew very, very little about self-injury. I had read about one article about it before I started the training. So that was quite something that I didn't know much about. So part of the training was about self-injury, why people did it, and issues relating to that. A lot of it was listening skills, because it wasn't for the helpline, and various topics we covered, like feminism, self-injury, obviously listening skills. And you know, it's awful, it's so long ago, I don't remember much else, but there were quite a few other topics that were covered each week. And it was quite a number of Saturdays. It was from about 10 to 4. And I think it must have been for about 8 weeks or more. And then if you were happy to go ahead and the organisation thought you were suitable, then you sat in on a couple of sessions and listened from the volunteers' end, and then took a call.
Do you remember how it made you feel doing the training and learning about self-injury?
Well, strangely enough, I just seemed to take it in my stride. I mean, obviously I was learning something new, and when you're learning something new, there's always something along the lines of, oh, can I do this? And it's challenging, but mainly I took it in my stride, and I was always worried I wasn't doing quite well, but obviously I was okay. And it was really nice meeting a bunch of different people and spending time with them, because although we were obviously training, as some of the training was practicing counselling or listening skills, and so you perhaps ended up talking about things you wouldn't have to people you didn't know very well. So in some ways, I think got to know some people a bit quicker than you would have in normal circumstances.
How many people were you working with at the time?
On the training course, it was quite a large training. I think it was around 8 to 10.
And who was your supervisor?
We at that time, because it was a collective, there was a number of different trainers, most of them volunteers. Sal was around quite a bit. Karen, Natty, who was a chair for a while, she wasn't around very much after I joined, but she came back to do a bit of training. There was a lady called Maureen who did some training, a lady called Karen. Hilary came occasionally, but at that time she wasn't doing it every week, but she did some training sessions. So I do remember Sal and say some of the others, but it was quite a few different people each week. Oh, Anna. There was an Anna as well. She did a bit.
Were there any strong personalities among the staff and the volunteers that you remember?
Not so much the staff and the volunteers doing the training, because I think they were doing it in a professional way. There were a couple of strong personalities in the volunteers. There was a lady called Sandy. She was quite a strong personality. There was a Welsh lady whose name I've forgotten. There was Mandy. I guess some of these you'll probably be talking to at some point. But overall, there was a lady who worked in the museums at Bristol City Council. But I think we probably gelled quite well, and there wasn't anyone who was over domineering.
What was the office like, and what was the atmosphere like in the office?
Well, we did our training in a room that they hired. It was above Off the Record, which they've now moved, near the bottom of St. Michael's Hill. It was quite a pleasant environment, and we used to take lunch to share every week. I think in the beginning we all brought really impressive things, and by the end, there's another lump of bread.
Did you tell people that you were volunteering at Bristol Crisis Service for Women?
I told one or two people, my closer friends, because it was something I hadn't done before. I didn't really want to tell lots of people in case I wasn't any good at it. I told people, but not lots of people.
What was their reaction when you told them?
Nobody really, I'm really boring. Nobody really had any strong reactions. Oh yeah, you might be good at that sort of thing. But that was about it, really.
Do you feel like the public perception of self-injury changed while you were volunteering at Bristol Crisis Service for Women?
Yes, because I was there for a very long time, because I only finally left last year. I think the perception has changed a lot. I still don't think it's as well understood as it could and should be, but it's certainly better understood and better known about than when I was first a volunteer. Because when I told people on occasions, they just didn't know what I was talking about. And you sort of had to try and explain what it was and why people might be doing it. I mean, I can remember one particular friend of my mother's. This was later on after my training, and it came up, and they said, oh yes, just people attention seeking. And I said, well, if someone's attention seeking, if they go that far, there really must be something wrong with them. But that's not usually the reason. But back then, that's what people thought. And there were lots of people don't actually tell people.
Did you feel like you were educating people that you knew that perhaps didn't understand self-injury?
A little bit, but perhaps I didn't talk about it. Although you asked how many people I told, over the years I probably told some people, but a lot of people weren't that interested and didn't ask, and I didn't sort of force it on people. So yes, there were occasions I felt when I was expanding people's understanding, but it wasn't something I perhaps did as much as I should have, because part of the aims of the charity is to promote understanding of the self-injury.
So what were the kinds of issues that helpline callers wanted to talk about?
Usually it was issues relating to their self-injury or their life. Sometimes it wasn't talking about self-injury a lot, but I think it was the acceptance that you understood that people self-injured and that you weren't judging them at so it was often other issues around their lives that perhaps self-injury had caused.
You joined Bristol Crisis Service for Women in 1994, and you only left last year, so you were there for 26 years. I mean, how did Bristol Crisis Service for Women change over that time?
Can I go back a step before I get to that? Because although I started on the helpline, I didn't stay on the helpline for very long. And it was not because I didn't want to work on the helpline. It was because I have a phobia and we had of mice, and we had mice in the office. And at the time we had a few Save the Mice Brigade. And so we had a few humane traps that don't work. And I knew that if I saw one, I would scream. So that isn't the right thing to do when you're working on a helpline. So I took some time off and I continued doing what we used to call day after counselling, where we were talking to our peers about their experiences on the helpline the day before or a few days before. And we changed the name after for a while, and I continued doing that till about 12 years ago, maybe slightly less. So I was still in touch with some of the issues and talking to people, but it was a bit secondhand. And I left it too late, and I felt if I went back to the helpline, I would have to retrain, or do some retraining, and it never happened. And it was really a shame, because I think I would have probably gone on for quite a long time if I hadn't have had that reason to come off it.
When did you become a trustee?
Well, that kind of evolved. You were asking about how things changed. And as I said earlier, I started, it was a collective. And I always feel that if I belong to an organisation, I should get involved as much as possible. So as it was expected that we attended business meetings, I started going and listening and joining in. And one of the ladies I trained with said, "Oh dear, this charity isn't a company limited by guarantee, and if they get into financial difficulties, if we become trustees, we will be liable." So it was around that time we started talking about becoming a company limited by guarantee. And I did a little bit on that with Hillary. We went to there was a law place that gave free advice on Stokes Croft. I forget what it was called. We went there, but it was very... because we were not used to companies, etc., it was quite difficult to get it set up as a company. But I probably didn't officially become a trustee until it was a company limited by guarantee, because as much as I had already become that I felt the organisation was important and doing important things, I also wanted to protect myself. So I was there when we talked about transforming into a company limited by guarantee, and then when we became one and set up a management group, and then it became more businesslike. And I think one of the reasons, apart from protecting ourselves, the reasons we moved away from being a collective is because it wasn't always working. Like, there wasn't always the decision making that needed to be done in the right way, because people could dip in and out. Even with trustees, sometimes they don't turn up when they're supposed to. But at least when you're on a management group, you kind of know more what's expected of you. So I think it was needed to move the organisation onto a more business-like footing, but in still a caring way. And certainly in the early years, and even up to when I left, the management group did more decision-making by consensus rather than any other way. So it kind of went on from its roots that we would make decisions by consensus rather than kind of falling out and arguing.
What sorts of things were you arguing over?
Well, unfortunately, going back to when I finished, not long after I finished my training, it was the first time I heard that we actually had a financial crisis, because we had just got some funding in. And during the time I was there, we had a number of funding crises, because not being a very well-known organisation, we didn't get much money from individual donors. So most of the funding came from foundations and other, well, when I first started, we were getting some from the government as well, but it was continually applying for grants for funding. So every so often there would be a funding crisis. And I mean, there was a time when people were made redundant, but we had funding come in and we were able to take them back on. But it isn't really very nice being a trustee and having to give people redundancy notices. And I must say, Hillary was so good. She was drawing up the letters even for her own redundancy on occasions. I'm obviously just dropping names in, but I'm sure everybody will know that Hillary is... was the director for a long time, and she was very good and helped guide us on the management group, although it was obviously our decision at the end of the day. Her input and guidance to us was invaluable, really.
Were there any tensions in the management group you can remember?
Not particularly. I think any might have been hidden. There was one particular time we had a problem. Going back, and I can't remember, it was a long time ago, we recruited directly for a chair. It must have been after Karen left, or Natty. I can't remember which order they came in. At the time, we were also having quite a focus on ritual and satanic abuse, and we had some training on it. She decided to go on the training, and it kind of quite spooked her. Probably, in hindsight, it was too much for someone who didn't know much about what we did. But strangely enough, I never met her. I was on holiday. And then there was another time I couldn't come to a meeting, and she left because of that. But we people were finding her too domineering, because definitely that time the chair was a figurehead, chaired the meetings, but wasn't somebody who was took lots of extra decisions or had extra power. And I think that's what she was trying to do. And quite a long time, since we're talking about that, quite a long time further on, we had another lady who was going to be chair or wanted to stand for chair, and we were concerned about how she was going on, because she had started talking about different people to each other behind our backs. And that was when Nina and I stood as co-chair, because we, and that's the only time we've ever had a vote for a chair in the whole time I was there, because we felt that she wouldn't be the right person for it. And unfortunately, because I think she had a lot to offer, but it was someone who once again thought it was kind of a power trip, I think, or wanted the organisation to go in a different way. And unfortunately, she left not long afterwards. But I think she would have had a lot to offer, but she just wasn't. There was something that wasn't gelling right, if you know what I mean. Well, not very well. Sorry, I'm probably not explaining very well.
Do you think that implementing a management board and becoming a limited company perhaps took away from the feminist collective that the service had started as?
Yes, it definitely went away from there. And I think definitely for quite a few of the first years as we were a management group and a company, it really was still going on the same ethos. But I think it got forgotten about over time as different people came in. They didn't really understand where the roots were, and that it was about making collective decisions. But having said that, apart from the two incidents I mentioned, we really didn't have any problems, I would say.
So was feminism something that was discussed a lot at Bristol Crisis Service for Women?
No, I don't think it was. When I had the training, we had training on feminism, if perhaps for people who weren't very understanding of it. But it was more we lived it rather than talked about it. So it wasn't talked about very much, I would say, or not when I was around. It was just that kind of you understood, or you were acting from that basis.
How do you think feminism's changed over that time?
Oh my goodness, that's a very wide-ranging question. Sadly, feminism hasn't achieved what we would have liked to achieve yet, but things have improved. But I still think that areas such as women's health and women's work still don't get equal recognition, or a lot of women perhaps equal. I would say equal pay, but some women don't actually want to climb to the top of the tree to get the best money. They want a quality of life as well. And I'm rambling. It has changed, but I'm finding it hard to put my finger on it.
What do you think it was about sort of the time that Bristol Crisis Service for Women was set up, was happening at the time from a feminist point of view for women? There seemed to be a rise in services similar to Bristol Crisis Service for Women.
I think perhaps that women had noticed enough that they weren't getting what they need, but they were also having enough confidence to get together to try and find a way to get what women needed. So I think that was kind of, I would say, overall, though a lot of women didn't get involved with things like that and or understand the importance. But I think there was things had progressed enough that women had more confidence and tried to get together to find ways to satisfy needs that they saw.
Do you think that we still need female-only spaces and services?
Yes, I think we do. And that's just a personal thing. As you probably gathered from my earlier comments, I've never self-injured. But I do think for women who've been self-injured and abused, it's really important that for some of them that they don't have to interact with men. They still find it harder to. And personally, I find initially I'm more comfortable with women till I get to know them. And I guess, you know, you go on about men, but they feel a bit the same. They often feel more comfortable with other men till they get settled in, because there is something you've got in common before anything else. And that isn't very well put, but there is some. But for women to have women only time, it is kind of, it satisfies some needs. I wouldn't like to have women only everywhere. There are times for when you want to perhaps share something with other women who might just understand a little bit more. Having said that, some men would understand too.
You mentioned ritual and satanic abuse. When was that happening, and what was going on around that?
Well, it's something that just cropped up as something that we... that sounds wrong. It was something that came up a few times and people felt they needed more training on. And in fact, the first training we had on it was actually a joint training that we did with Womankind, Mind, and another organisation, another women's organisation in Bristol, and I can't remember. That was a long time ago. And it wasn't actually about that, but it came up. It was more about dissociative personality disorder, and often people who have that have been abused in the worst kind of ways. And kind of, yes, so it did seem an issue for our callers for a while, which is why we had the extra training on it, or one or two of our callers. Because we didn't identify our callers. Each time they called was unique, going back in the days when I was working on the helpline. And although you couldn't help remembering people, we tried to keep it as a separate call. But it did mean that you kind of knew a few of the issues in a more long-term way for some callers.
Are there any particular calls that stood out for you?
Strangely enough, it was the mistakes that stood out. I remember one particular mistake. One lady had told me how she'd self-injured. And I said, ow. You know, like, ow! And that is not the right response. But strangely enough, because it sounded painful when she told me, but strangely enough, it actually opened up something that I don't think it would have opened up if I hadn't have said ow in that way. But it was a mistake, because it wasn't a considered reaction. It was, oh my goodness, that hurt. But that kind, then there's just a few that, thinking about it now, you kind of still, I probably don't know their names, but you can just remember them.
How did you look after yourself?
Well, we had the day after counselling, and I was very lucky. For a long time, I had Hillary. For me, that was probably enough. I did have a habit of coming home and raiding the fridge. I think that was a bit of comfort eating. But I do that sometimes anyway. But talking about it seemed to be enough for me. And I think that is something that comes from ourselves. And if you can't be empathetic at the time, but then put it aside, and that's something that comes from within you, then you can't really do it. Because if it affects you too much for too long, then it's not good for you, and you have to look after yourself first.
Were there any people that you worked with that were really affected by the calls that they took?
I think possibly. I don't really know of anyone who had particularly awful calls that when I was working with them, or anyone that I did day after counselling with, or peer support as we later called it, that had particularly bad call that stayed with them for a long time. But I do know that some of the people that I'd probably say that couldn't put it aside probably didn't stay on the helpline for very long because it wasn't good for them, and they probably upset them. But those people tended to drift away rather than sort of say I've, or they might have said it to other people, perhaps people who were looking after the rota at the time or their day after counsellor. But if you can't somehow empathise with the call while you're there, but almost put it away in a good way, you can't do it for long because it... Yeah, I'm repeating myself. But for me personally, I didn't ever find that I had... It affected me badly. I mean, sometimes you'd be walking along and, you know, I was used to walk to work at the time, and I'd be sort of thinking about something completely, something different, and a thought would come in my mind about the call I'd taken. And but it wasn't huge emotions. It was thinking about it, chewing it over. And I guess... Yeah, that's how it was for me anyway. And I don't think it made me any less empathetic, but I was doing what you needed to do naturally. I was putting it aside and carrying on with my life the rest of the time.
Did you have any frequent callers that you perhaps built a relationship with?
Well, it was discouraged for us to build a relationship, as I alluded to earlier. Each call of up to an hour was treated as individual, and we tried not to build relationships with anybody or refer back to things that they'd said in previous calls, because one of the things at the time, and I think the helpline might be set up slightly differently now, is that if someone said something last week, they might not want it referred to or even remembered next week. Though I think there were others that would have preferred an ongoing dialogue. And there were a couple of callers that would ask for a particular person, but that wasn't actually... you weren't allowed to hand the call over to someone else. That was part of the policy.
Do you remember there being any particularly busy periods where you'd get lots of calls?
Well, it was never really anything other than busy. We'd start, because at that time it was weekends, and it was 9 to 12, I think, if I remember correctly. And as soon as you put the phones on the hook, they would ring. If you had, and I think some of the regular callers worked out that most people stayed on for an hour. So sometimes if you had someone who wasn't on for very long, the phone might not ring for very long. But after each call, you'd take a bit of time to have a coffee and sort of, you know, just get back to a normal place. Oh, that sounds wrong too. Just feel calm again. And then you put the phone back on the hook and it would ring. And very rarely did it stay silent for more than 5 minutes once you put it back on the hook. But as I said, I think a lot of the regular callers worked out a good time to get through. And we didn't know how many people were trying whilst we were on the phone.
What impact did being involved with Bristol Crisis Service for Women have on your life?
It seemed to just fit in some ways. Maybe there were a few gaps there. Maybe that's why I stayed for so long, but once you, I just sometimes when I was still on the helpline, it was a bit annoying if somebody rang up and said, do you want to do something this Saturday? And I was already doing on the helpline. But other than that, it seemed to fit in quite nicely.
You said that you worked in quite a male-dominated industry. What were you doing for work?
I was actually worked in, for Bristol City Council in Waste. And I was at that time, Waste was very male-dominated. There weren't many people, many women in the sections I worked in. So it was quite different. I quite enjoyed it. I mean, there wasn't a problem with it.
So why did you leave Bristol Crisis Service for Women?
Well, I thought of leaving a few times over the years because I was, by the time after, say, 11, 12 years ago, I was just going to the management meetings and I didn't know if I had enough to offer. And sometimes, but then often there weren't quite enough trustees, and the fact that I was there and committed was probably good. But towards the end, well, not towards the end, a few years before, we had people not turning up for meetings, and I was probably as bad as anybody, because when I was planning for a meeting, then it got cancelled because nobody was going to turn up. I started giving priority to other things. So perhaps I wasn't quite as... I got as committed as I should have been. Because, yeah, I remember once I thought a meeting wouldn't go ahead, so I arranged to go to my book club. I probably should have gone to the meeting. But I thought it'd get cancelled like the previous one because not enough people would turn up. Because that kind of went through a bad phase. But when I finally left, I was a little bit unhappy and it was very sad.
What sort of shape do you think you left Bristol Crisis Service for Women in?
I think they're in very, when I left, they were in very good shape, and hopefully they have actually learnt from it, because I did actually say in my resignation letter that I felt I had been discriminated against. And I think that probably was a bit of a shock, but it shouldn't have been.
Did they get back to you about that? Did they respond?
I had a couple of people say that, sorry, I was leaving. I probably was a bit stroppy at the time, so I might not have been very approachable. I was a bit saddened that I didn't hear from a couple of the staff in a personal way, who I'd known for a long time. But that's it.
Were there any other cases of discrimination during your time there that either you'd experienced or that you'd witnessed?
Not that I know of, because it has been a very open organisation in most times. I don't know if other people had personal issues that I never heard about. But I hadn't felt that was the type of organisation that we were. And I don't think it is. I was very unlucky, and it wasn't a very good way to leave. It kind of left a bad taste in my mouth, so to speak.
Do you have much to do with what is now self-injury support now?
Well, my Amazon, Smile Amazon's still going donations to them, so I haven't cancelled that. I'm not in touch with any current, apart from when this project came up, and Rosie emailed me. I haven't been in touch with anyone since I resigned. I occasionally hear from Heather on Facebook, who was a volunteer a long time ago, but she left before I did, a long time before I did. But nobody who's there now.
So how did you feel when Bristol Crisis Service for Women changed its name to Self-Injury Support in 2014?
Now, that was a very painful change of name. We were talking about it for so long, and finding a name that everyone agreed on was so difficult. It was very painful for something that perhaps shouldn't have been. Well, I say painful, I don't mean, you know, wringing our hands in about it, but there was a lot of talk and it took a long time.
How did you get to the name Self-Injury Support?
Do you know, I should remember. It is in the minutes, but of the management group meetings, we said that Bristol Crisis Service for Women didn't really indicate what we did. For national funders, it sometimes made us look local. So the ones that didn't sort of go into it in any depth might have dismissed us because of our name. So at the time, we thought we probably should have something more about our main focus in the name. And it's a lot of suggestions, and I don't really quite remember how we came up with Self-Injury Support. It seemed to be the best option of the names that we'd come up with. No. You were saying, do I remember any of the other suggestions? No. I felt a bit sad about losing Bristol Crisis Service for Women, and I kept calling it that for a long time afterwards.
Do you think that the name change has helped with funding since?
Well, there was one comment I heard once that maybe the name wasn't helping, but I think overall, hopefully it has. Because once again, although the focus is on self-injury, it is about more than self-injury. It is about women in emotional distress. You know, go back to our, I've forgotten what, you know, what we are at a beginning, what we say we are. It is about women in emotional distress, particularly women who self-injure. So it isn't it wasn't just about self-injury, it was about other mental health issues as well.
What was the best thing about working at Bristol Crisis Service for Women?
I think it was meeting a lot of different people that I wouldn't have, other women, I should say, that I wouldn't have met. I've never made any close friends from any of the people I've met at Bristol Crisis Service for Women or self-injury support, but there were people I was friendly with and it was nice to chat to and just nice to know. And, you know, if you sort of ask me now, I'll ask you, people that I remember, volunteers and management group, there are a lot of people that stand out in my mind as being nice women that I met along the way.
Did it make you angry at any point? Sort of having to, you know, take all these calls of women in real emotional distress?
I probably should have done, but I don't think it did. Probably because you were too much in the moment dealing with the actual call. But if you stand back and think about it, yes, it should make all women angry that women are, that the reasons women self-injure are actually still happening. Especially, I would say, the women who self-injure badly. The reasons for it are still happening, and women are still being damaged because of things that happen to them. So yes, it's a general anger at the world. It's not, I wouldn't say, a specific anger.
What did you find challenging during your time there?
I guess the initial challenge was doing something that I'd never done before, taking the calls. And then when I became a management group, some of the things we had to deal with, for example, I mentioned earlier, redundancies, making decisions that are really not decisions we had to make because of no money. Not being able to do some of the things, difficult decisions. Yeah, but it was difficult not to be able to do some of the things we would like to have done because we didn't have the money. And just sometimes doing something new that you hadn't done before. And I can't think of an example.
If you did have the money, what might you have liked to have done with it?
Expanded. Helplines or support services. I think there is still a need for it. I think it's, although self-injury support is quite well recognised within a sector of the people who deal with self-injury, I would have liked the organisation to be better known and us to have the facilities to go out and talk to more people. Because till COVID, I was always quite keen on our training, which I assume they have. I know Sal was working on trying to do more online training, but I always thought our training was really important and would like to have done more of it because it did two things. It brought money in, but it was actually furthering our charitable aims, which was to help women in distress, the more people who understood and could deal with it, better. But it also was expanding people's understanding of it as well.
So since you first joined, how had the service expanded in terms of people on the helpline and permanent staff?
Well, there's definitely more permanent staff. When I started, there was only Hillary. Then we had an admin person. We extended the helpline opening hours, and then really, really sadly, and I can't remember the year again, due to funding, we actually had to shut the helpline. And the current helpline was one that was restarted again with new funding, we had the text and email service, which was very new, which started when we did it. It wasn't that as common as it is now, that a lot of organisations have text and email. And it was really good that we did that. I've lost the question, sorry.
But I have. Do you think that funding is a feminist issue because lots of funding is controlled by men?
I hadn't ever thought of it that way before. Possibly, but a lot of organisations that aren't women only have problems with funding too. The real reason is there isn't enough money to go around, or given that, because there is enough money to go around, there isn't enough money allocated for mental health services and women's services.
So what memories from Bristol Crisis Service for Women really stand out for you?
I guess starting on the helpline. Some of our social events, we didn't have many, but, you know, meals and some of the training, not the initial training, but we had the odd training day and we had way days for the management group. Some of the AGMs, I can remember one where Natty was the chair. She brought flowers along and there was a male accountant come to talk to us and she gave him a flower as well. Well, she couldn't leave him out, could she? Some of the people, I mentioned Heather and Sylvia. Nicola, she's was on the management group for a long time, in Emma. There's a lot of people who I've gone off the subject, like, but it's just kind of memories of people really that stood out for one reason or another. And staff too, Hilary, Gisela, Sal, well, she was a volunteer when I first met her.
Are there any particular events that you can remember?
Well, I can remember our 10th birthday party, because that was the year I started. So hopefully I've got that right, that I started in 1994 and the birthday party was that year. So that was good, because it was all new then, and I met some of the older volunteers who had actually left, who came back for the event. I can remember that there was this long list of names of volunteers that had already gone, you know, been and gone, that was sort of hanging down. So that was kind of outstanding because it was the beginning in some ways. We had a big, I think it was 20th birthday party, but it might be in the wrong year, when we had an event at the council house, which is now called City Hall. There's quite a few things really.
What did you do for the 10th anniversary?
Sort of snacky things, and there was the odd someone talked, and it was just meeting people. It just stands out. I don't actually remember much about what we did. It was a building in Orchard Street, which we'd hired for a Saturday, I think.
I should have asked this earlier. Do you remember your first call?
I don't think I do. I remember a couple of earlier calls. I remember one I probably should have handled better, but I don't think I do.
Were you nervous?
Yeah, terrified.
And I guess more broadly, which areas do you think that Bristol Crisis Service for Women has had a significant influence on?
I think perhaps getting understanding of self-injury out there, and especially with the other organisations that we've had contact with, and that's probably more the paid members of staff than the volunteers, although the volunteers have sometimes been involved as well. One of the things that I do remember is our party when we got the Queen's Award. That's something special. It wasn't a huge party. We had the Lieutenant of Bristol come and award it to us. I think there might still be a picture on the wall, or there was in the offices at one time. I don't know what's happened, and there should still be the award.
What was the award for?
It's a bit like a MBE for charities. So it's for what we did, really. But Hilary and Emma went to an event at Buckingham Palace, a garden party, I think it was, because we had the invitations because we had it. I didn't fancy going. I didn't even put my name forward. But that was something memorable. Obviously, you're not very good at recalling memorable events.
What role do you see self-injury support playing in 2021? Is it the same role as it was back in 1984 when it was first set up, and in the 90s when you joined?
I think yes and no. There are some things that are still the same. Hopefully, there are other organisations, a lot more organisations now that have self-injury as one of the things that they have expertise in. But there is still the organisation that has expertise, has done research more than once. I did see possibly in the future more research, because that's a way of validating the organisation as well. Obviously the support services and the training, yes, I can still see there is an important place for it, because unfortunately the reason the organisation is there is still happening. What would be utopia is that there's no need for the organisation because there's nobody that needs the support.
Is there anything else that you can remember from your time there that you want to talk about, or anything that you wanted to add?
No,
to what you've said?
I think there was just so many committed people over the years. Some people who were there for just a short time, and some people who were there for a long time. And once I didn't really know the volunteers in recent years who were doing support services, because without them the organisation wouldn't have kept going. And for me, what stands out, as I said before, some of the people and what they did. I like them.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your experience. It's been such a privilege to hear. Thank you.
Thank you.